That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
For 15 years, I've been trying to teach you how to write a lead. Do I have to do everything myself? Get the story? Write the story?
Listen, saphead, I could blow a better story out of my nose than you can write.
That's right, you fans of the ink stained scribes or ink scribed stains. We are in the Week in Review on Friday on KUOW with Knut Berger. Who just, you hear that and you just remember your past.
I do. I really do.
Eli Sanders of The Stranger, you hear that and remember your present.
I was just going to say that.
And Joni Balter of The Seattle Times, you hear that and remember your future.
There you go. There you go. You're a little wild. I think it's that clip at the top here.
I love those clips. And if anybody has any other good journalism movie clips or TV, please send them along to us. I was looking for some good Lou Grant ones.
I was
and
just
Mary Tyler
Lou
Moore,
Grant.
And I couldn't find any good ones where she's just not going, oh, Mr. Grant.
No, the great Mary Tyler Moore one is the one where she's chattering and he says, you know, you've got spunk. And she goes, thanks. He goes, I hate spunk.
I like it when she throws her hat up in the air. That doesn't work on radio.
All right. Week in Review at KUOW.org. Send some clips. Week in Review is all one word. Week in Review at KUOW.org. Send some suggestions for clips, or maybe you have some ideas you'd like to float in this post-election idea floating time, and you've been tracking the news as we have. Share some of your thoughts. Week in Review at KUOW.org. Two things just at the top, because they're not. They're not done yet. The SeaTac minimum wage, they're still leading, but it's not been called one way or the other, right?
It's been narrowing a little bit, the victory there.
So that is still up in the air. Also, the Shama Sawant Richard Conlon race, not yet decided. And I think, I don't care where I was reading it, but a lot of people have been writing. Oh, Jim Brunner said it in the Times, too. Other people have said it. The trends continue. Oh, you walked in and said it, didn't you, Knut? Trends continue, she could actually maybe pull it out?
Well, yeah. I mean, the ballot counts are shifting in her favor, the later counts. It's if she gets at least 53% of the rest of the votes, which she did in the last ballot count, she'll win. Hmm. So if that race is going to be narrow, it seems like the late voters went her way, but I've also heard that Conlon had a last-minute drop and also worked last-minute votes, too. So he's still ahead, but narrowing fast.
But he also, on election the day after the election, said that he, seeing that the district elections were coming, was not going to seek re-election in 2015, which sort of makes it funny when you think about how close this race is. Was that the right timing?
Well, he couldn't influence any more votes anyways, right?
In a way, what he was doing was conceding to Kashama Sawant in 2015, because they will both be in a district running against each other, and that district will have a core of supporters that will definitely or would definitely give Kashama the win over Conlon.
The Schwinn.
I think.
Are you very upset about the loss of Mayor McGinn?
I think it was a mistake on Richard's part to do that. I mean, obviously, if he loses, it doesn't make any difference. If he wins, he's declared himself a lame duck right up front. And he sort of said that he just, the heat in that kitchen was too hot for him. And he kind of made Sawant's case for replacing him by you know, projecting him as kind of tired and part of business as usual. And, you know, candidates, socialist candidates and other candidates often declare a moral victory when they lose. And they say, well, we changed the debate. You know, we made this campaign about us. So we won a moral victory. I think here she's actually won a moral victory, not just, I mean, in the sense that not only is she very close, but she effectively forced her opponent out.
Well, voters don't want to hear you say the night after the election that, geez, that was all so exhausting, and I don't know if I'll be there in 2 years from now, and I plan not to.
Well, I mean, was it more than a moral victory? Do we see, Danny Westneat wrote about this, a lot of folks have been writing and thinking about this, are we seeing a, even though Mike McGinn could have been considered, maybe he should have followed on that trend, are we seeing a trend taking this city further left?
Well, that has been the, you know, this new left has been the question, not just here, but with the election of New York Mayor de Blasio.
I'm just all going to be punts today. The left or the left came back. Anyways, go ahead. The new left.
The new left is this, you know, trend that's going on, and it will very much depend on if that CTAC minimum wage pulls it out here in the final vote counts, which go, you know, until like next year or something like that.
Not that long.
Not that long.
But in the context of just the Seattle races, when you're parsing shades of left, I think everyone put McGinn to the left of Murray and he didn't win. So I think the idea of a trend kind of stops there. If there's a trend, it's just a trend of one at the moment, which is not a trend.
Yeah,
he said, proclaiming what a trend looks like.
I think the interesting thing will be to if Sawant wins and is on the city council, to see whether she'll learn anything from McGinn's loss. And that is that, you know, she has an ideology that is far left, I think, by any definition. And she, you know, comes out of the kind of Occupy movement and she's a socialist. But the question will be, can she work with the council or will she be someone who uses those issues as divisive? Coltrane's would be an example because you hear her during the campaign talking about having the masses rise up and, you know, blocking the Coltrane's and that kind of thing. You know, well, that kind of activist or contentious approach, I mean, it's very difficult if you're an administrator, but it's also difficult if you're a legislator to some degree because you have to work with the other council members. So, you know, how she fits in that way, I think, will be really interesting to watch, or not going a different way.
But if she wins, she will have won citywide, and then she will never need to win citywide again, assuming districts stay put. So I think there actually could be a lot more room for her to be, quote unquote, divisive in, you know, what we call in Seattle divisive, or play to her base, which will be Capitol Hill and Madrona, really, in her new district. And so I think she will be insulated from the problem that McGinn had, which was that he riled up more conservative Seattle, the Seattle that didn't like, you know, what they call bomb throwers or people who stir the pot. She is representing an area of the city that wants precisely that. And so she will, as of now, really be representing that district and have cover to do what she wants and they want.
Well, she's also going to have to deliver on all of the kind of lunch bucket issues that every district is going to be concerned. People on Capitol Hill are concerned about potholes. They're concerned about, you know, a lot of the detail stuff. And she's going to have to work with the other council members.
But in terms of passed. Right. But in terms of, you know, the question of moral victory, she may fall into that very familiar position of a politician who fights the good fight against the rest of the city and loses and loses and loses, but fights for what her district wants and maybe slowly moves the ball.
Yes, but one of the promises of district elections is that these elections will be very lively and dynamic, that there'll be a lot of challenging going on. And so you can't assume that even if she did win that district in the first go-round, if she'd be back the second go-round, because it's supposed to be so retail politics. The other thing that struck me this week was the nature of the transition team for the new mayor. Martha Cho, who used to be on the city council, and Ed Murray was her aide. I was down there at the time. And then Dwight Dively. And these folks all connect. Dwight Dively, if you want to go back in time, was on council central staff. Then he was the budget director. Then he went to the county to work on their budget. And it sort of has this feeling that the sturdy hands of government are back in charge.
When you say I want to come back to this, but since you brought it up, he went to the council? Did he like say, okay, thanks? I mean, there was a little bit of politics.
Oh, there was quite a bit of politics. You know, went is one of those words, Steve,
whereby somebody else was put above him by Mike McGinn.
The new mayor named Beth Goldberg to be his budget director. Everyone was shocked because Dwight Dively was known as the best budget director in three or four states or something like that. And so Dow Constantine picked him up. And he seemed quite happy, actually, at the county. But just the presence of him on this sort of had a sort of a sturdy hand. You know, we understand budgets here. We understand how to run this government.
I want to go back to districts for just a sec.
We're going to, you know, actually, I'm coming. This is like cats today. I'm coming back to districts.
Yeah.
I just want to ask two other things about Sawant, and then because I want to spend a little more time on districts than that even, which is why did she do so well? So where are we now? 51 to 48%. She's got Conlon's ahead by 4,000 plus votes out of 128,000 cast. What happened? Why did she do so well? Or why did he do so poorly? Either way.
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I think that Richard Conlon's strengths were in details of government that just are not easy to run on when you're running against somebody who's charismatic and who's articulating bigger issues that people are passionate about, like the idea of affordability, rent control, and the $15 an hour wage. Conlon's achievements have often, some of them have been significant in terms of his role in the zero waste policies for Seattle, a lot of the sustainability stuff. He was there early and often. But I, you know, in looking at some of the debates that they had, you had somebody who was making a very passionate, emotional, articulate case about livability. And then Richard Conlon's answer would be, you know, I got a pedestrian bicycle bridge for Northgate. I don't think Conlon was running on his record, but when you have a challenger like that with that kind of appeal and the case they're making, you have to respond to what they're saying, not running on the record that is pretty wonky. And, you know, that's one of the things I like about Richard Conlon, but it didn't work.
Well, I would say that in Seattle, you know, we talk about we want these districts and we want to have, you know, this representation down to the geographic level. But people also want someone who's speaking about the growing number of people who rent. Again, you know, this is a big deal in this city. I've heard a number of people talk about, I don't feel like I have a representative who understands people who are renting or paying for condos or something like that. It's a different dynamic. And she has brought some of that.
You know who ran on that?
Nicastro.
Yes, exactly. Judy Nicastro. It is the Judy Nicastro argument and case, and that was a very compelling case. She probably would have won re-election were it
until it
been
wasn't
for Strippergate
for her situation. Yes,
was it Strippergate or
yeah, she was?
Yes, it was the Colicurcio situation.
Okay, I'm confusing it with. Never mind. I won't bring it up.
Don't confuse us.
What were you going to say, though?
There was someone who also had a DUI maybe before or after the election. I don't.
Forget that.
Well, you asked me to say it.
Oh, I thought you had something else about Sawant. Sawant. This is good today.
I think I was going to echo strongly what Knut said, that Sawant was, you know, it was sort of change versus more of the same, which we've seen before. And Conlon, yes, you know, when you go back through it, you can find his record. But when he talked about it, I guess it sounded very thin. The thing that he was most known about, at least in the circles that I was in, was the legislation allowing you to have pet goats.
Have goats. You know, Conlon was doorbelling for the first time in my district in my day anyways, which I had not met him before at my doorbell. And so that told me something about
what he was then concerned, it sounds like, because
you're going to say and then you're going to say. So what were you going to say?
Oh, I wanted to respond to something Joni said because I think it kind of hit the nail on the head about renters.
It's not going to happen every day.
No, it isn't. but no, I think you get at something really I've been doing this history of condominiums in Seattle, like where they started and everything. So I happen to be talking to a guy who's kind of the condo marketing expert. He's not a salesman. He does market research. His name is O'Connor. And he was telling me that one of the really interesting things is the condo market is not doing very well right now. And one reason is because the millennial generation are renters. And he said one of the huge things that the millennial generation people are waiting to see is, are they going to stay renters or are they going to become buyers? And that's both a function of economics, economy, class, wages, but it's also an effect of mobility and whether people have kids, when they get married, and that kind of thing. And I think there's I think this issue of, even though Seattle can't institute rent control on its own, that issue of tenant rights, affordability, the fact that the younger generation is not necessarily going to follow the same pattern as the parents or grandparents is significant.
Also because they lived through at a formative moment a gigantic housing bust.
Yeah, and they were affected by
right.
it and remain affected by it, right?
Yeah.
All right, let me take a break. We were talking about what happened in the Seattle City Council race with Kshama Sawant, who is behind, but the votes were trending in her direction for the last few times the votes were counted. And as new votes are counted, we also were talking about what was happening more broadly in the outcome of the election, which we were going to come back to, districts and what happened with the city of Seattle transition. Also what happened in Bellevue, talk a little bit about what happened in Bellingham and Coltrane's, and the war on Christmas continues. Or maybe it's the war on gay Christmas. We'll find out. This is the Week in Review.
Also in the news, the Washington legislature is meeting in special session to vote on billions of dollars in tax exemptions for Boeing. Special tax breaks for Boeing. What do you think about that? Should we give tax breaks to Boeing? Who benefits more from that, Boeing or the state of Washington? Give us a call, 206-221-3663. Tax breaks for Boeing, yay or nay, why or why not? Your thoughts now, 206-221-3663. Thanks.
Support for KUOW comes from Puget Sound Blood Center, serving patients in 75 hospitals and clinics across the Pacific Northwest, where donors can make a difference by donating blood this holiday season. Information at psbc.org/donate. Puget Sound Blood Center, saving lives every day.
51 degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. Forecast says maybe some sun breaks today along with scattered showers and a high of 52.
That's a little Joe Strummer, by the way. You want to get the honey, don't go killing all the bees.
Whoa. Okay. I'll keep that
Johnny on. Appleseed. This is the Week in Review. I'm Steve Scherr, Eli Sanders, Associate Editor at The Stranger, Joni Balter with the Seattle Times, Knute Berger writes the Mossback column at crosscut.com, among other places, Seattle Magazine as well. You had predicted, Joni, that districts was going to win because it was such a quiet campaign.
It was the sleeper of the election. It's like, you know, I was at this event the other night and a couple of city council members were there and the look on their face was stunned because, you know, this thing did not receive that much attention as it did in other years. It went down three other times or was it four? I forget. But the gist of it is that we didn't really talk about this much and it has big impact on this city. And the way these two council members who were at this event, Tim Burgess and Sally Bagshaw, were talking about this. It really changes the way the council approaches issues. You know, we've been talking about how that North District, if you look at the map of where the council members live, and the due North District of Seattle did not have a representation. Southeast has two. But you'll start hearing quite a lot about ye olde sidewalks is what you're going to hear about from that North District.
I'm sure you're right. So Seattle voters approved districts for city council elections.
And you'll also see Tim Burgess and Sally Bagshaw sorting out who is going to run for the district that they both live in. You've got several districts that have – yes.
Yeah, they both
yeah,
do.
Yeah, they do. You have several districts that have two current council members in them right now. Licata and O'Brien are in the same district, and there's another one with two that I'm
Southeast
right
has
now.
Bruce Harrell and Sally Clark.
Right.
Yes.
And so if everyone wants to stay in the game, they're going to have to somehow negotiate who runs for the at-large seats and who runs for the district seats, or they're going to duke it out amongst themselves, which is what people like us of The Stranger who backed districts wanted to see. There's this phenomenon going on where it was getting very, very hard to challenge a sitting council candidate. And people who supported districts like The Stranger wanted them in part because it would shake things up on the council.
They're gonna collude to decide who does what.
Well,
that would be illegal if they were
politicians would never do
trading.
That. There's one other interesting facet of the district vote that's worth pointing out. I don't know if it will amount to anything, but the 5th district currently has no council member, sitting council member living in it. It covers Greenwood and thereabouts. There is one person who's currently out of a job and lives in the 5th district. That's Mayor McGinn. So it will be interesting to see whether he is interested at all in that opportunity.
I think districts is a hugely consequential decision. It doesn't surprise me that it passed. I think it sounds very appealing. A lot of people in the city are from elsewhere where they have districts in, you know, most other major cities. So it's a system people are used to. And there was no real opposition to it. In other words, it kind of went out there. Nobody talked about it. And in previous efforts, there's been an avid no campaign against districts. I think there'll be a number of significant changes. One is that I think it's going to strengthen the mayor. In other words, I think it will balkanize the council to a certain degree. It will it will make the mayor the key person who's answerable citywide. And I think that I think it'll have the effect of we have kind of a weak mayor, strong council. You know, I think we'll have a stronger mayor under the system. Also think there'll be more competition citywide in the various districts, and that will do two things. One, it's going to draw a ton of money to these. I think the idea that districts is going to – you will be able to get into a campaign with less money and do the shoe leather thing, knocking on all the doors because the district is smaller. But a lot of money is spent in legislative district races. I was talking with some consultants and downtown folks. They're looking at it and seeing multiple independent expenditure campaigns set up for different districts and different issues. So you're going to have a lot of money funneling in, but those things will be very targeted now to different parts of the city. And then I think on the other side of that, one thing I was hearing some people suggest is that we'll see a return of slate politics to Seattle.
Slate politics.
Yeah, and this is where you get five neighborhood candidates running on a citywide slate and spreading the money citywide, sharing the cost of that. You might get a socialist slate, a progressive slate. You know, you'll have the opportunity, I think, to begin to develop citywide campaigns that are run on the district level. That makes it easier to get some of the individuals elected, but you give them some oomph.
Well,
media-wise,
look no further here for some explanation of what will happen to the county council. One of the arguments in district elections, even though you didn't hear very many of these on either side during the campaign, the non-campaign, however you want to phrase that, you'll have a lot of challengers. But the county council, which is district, often doesn't have many challengers. It's something that really wasn't answered because, and I have no idea why this happened, but there just wasn't money to either really be dramatically for districts or dramatically against. So you didn't hear this debate that has come up so many times. And so the question is this the promise of it, or is it really going to happen? Because if you look at the county council, that's not what happens.
I think there is a big difference, though. County council districts are large, and city council districts are going to be small. So what Knute said is probably true. You will have people who will find ways to pump big targeted money into district races, but the barrier to entry for a challenger is so much lower. You can do, like he was saying, you can get around a district on your feet over the course of a campaign for free and meet, you know, everyone who comes to a door in that district conceivably and perhaps neutralize the effect of money that way.
Well, the one place that did happen in the county council years ago was when, at that time, an unknown Bob Ferguson went after fellow Democrat Cynthia Sullivan. He actually went through, I forget how many pairs of loafers, but quite a few. He knocked on all the doors and he ended up
three times in my neighborhood. I met him three times.
Oh, wow.
Well, they seem to be home a lot. Huh?
In terms of people who think they'll benefit from districts, you have a non-ideological base of a lot of people, because you have people you have neighborhood people, you have certain ethnic groups, you have local business groups, you have a lot of different people who felt they would benefit. I think one of the things will be that with districts is the council will have, and this can be both the plus and minus of districts, but you'll have a much more parochial sense of politics. Everybody is going to want their issue front and center, and they're going to want their sidewalks, their roads, or whatever. So I suspect you'll see a lot more horse trading, kind of like Congress used to be.
I'll give you sidewalks, you give me something in
something. Yeah, and these things will be very, very local.
All right, so that's my question. Let's imagine that. So you are in the 3rd district, if I'm not mistaken, where you live. What district do you live in, the 2nd or the 3rd?
I don't know the number. Southeast Seattle, where we have two representatives currently.
And you're in the 3rd district, too.
Capitol Hill?
Yeah. And I'm in, it looks like I might be in the 4th district. What do I want
you
in
tell
my
us.
District?
You tell us,
Steve.
That is going to interest you in some way in on the Capitol Hill district. And what kind of horse trading might we be thinking about here? I mean, I know that the folks who are living up north, they might want those sidewalks and maybe some gutters.
Maybe a few potholes
filled for everybody. That's a citywide one.
That's citywide, though. Yes. I want to know what, if it balkanizes us, what is Magnolia concerned about that is of no interest to somebody in Rainier Beach?
Well, the third district stretches from the Ship Canal down to the central area. It's on the lake.
Yeah, and then I-5.
But I can tell you one recent issue that infuriated a lot of people in Montlake and Madison Park and Madison Valley and some parts of Capitol Hill was 520, the 520 project. There was a lot of neighborhood opposition to the plans. That's probably one of the things that I'll be interested to see the votes, because a lot of people didn't like Conlon as he took a point position on pushing the West Side solution that was a bigger freeway through. And now that's just one issue, but my guess is if we had had districts, that district would have wanted somebody who was maybe more skeptical about the 520 expansion than people were in some of the other districts.
And then is it going to be more fun to be one of the at-large, one of the two at-large under this system? Because, you're looking at the whole city.
You'll be like a Canadian senator.
There you go.
You can just stand back and take the money. All right.
They're like the Uber council member, because they will hear from all over the city and they have to represent the whole city.
All right. One question about the mayor's race and then a question about the transition. Everybody predicted pretty much that Mike Begin would lose. I didn't think he'd lose. I thought he might lose, but I didn't think he might lose by the amount he lost. And that's a big loss. So I think it was you when we were talking off air saying, well, it started at the day he got elected. There was his own actions and then a wave of negative views of him.
I don't think it was the day he got elected, but I think the first year was very troublesome for him and sort of his relationships with a lot of people. The stories built on stories. There was a story out of the chamber how he didn't want to meet with them. There were stories how hard it was to get together and talk with him. He was very afraid from the beginning of sort of being seen as a kind of a power broker mayor. He wanted, he would even say, I'll meet with community councils, but not like the chamber. And it built over time. And as you know, one of the toughest moments for him was when he sort of had second thoughts about what he'd said in the campaign about the tunnel. And that stuck with a lot of people. And the question, I asked his consultant this the other night, John Weibel, was this race decided 3 years ago? I'm not talking about the percentage.
Yeah.
That obviously moved around. And he pretty much said there was something to that idea, that the voters sort of turned on him years ago and he didn't build it back enough to do any better.
I heard that from a lot of analysis here. Let's just hear what Mike McGinn had to say about that when he was talking in his concession.
Any time I was rubbing people the wrong way, I think that's where that was coming from. Just try to do what is right, let the chips fall where they may. Don't try to take the politically expedient out. Try to do the right thing. And I made a bet that, people would see what we were trying to accomplish and they'd be supportive of it in the long run. And the fact is, a lot of the things I'm pushing for now, have become the agenda of this city. So I feel like I did move the debate, even if I may have done some things that rub people the wrong way occasionally.
So, there's the move the debate part, but the rubbing people the wrong way part, did it start 3 years ago? I mean, did he lose this election 3 years ago?
I agree with Joni about that. I think you only have one chance to make a first impression, and that first year, I think, really hurt him, and he never recovered. Even his own coalition fractured a bit. He expanded it in some areas, but in other areas, like the club owners, there were parts of his group that peeled off. The C.R. Douglas had, I'm going to quote another pundit here because I was talking with him this morning. He had a really interesting theory. He doesn't believe the 3 year ago theory. He thinks that Mike McGinn would have won re-election, but the election was lost in Sacramento. which was that if Mike McGinn, if they had gotten a yes on the Sonics franchise, that that would have created a momentum and enthusiasm and would have pulled the rug out from under the kind of coalition building cooperative mayor argument that Murray was making. And so he thought it was a defeat that you could blame on the fact that the arena project got stalled.
That's interesting.
I thought that was an interesting theory.
That's our producer Jason Pagano's theory as well, that if there had been pictures of Mike McGinn shooting hoops with Gary Payton and saying twirling a basketball saying, I got you a basketball team, he would have won.
Well, what about the day when the Police Officers Guild came out for the opponent? I thought that was a pretty big day in all of this, because if you recall, the whole tussle with Department of Justice was a mayor defending his own police department from some of these charges and the degree of those charges. And so the day that the Police Officers Guild went the other way, I thought was a pretty interesting piece of this puzzle here.
You know, we were talking about whether McGinn cemented his image in a kind of negative way from day one or from his first year. And you can look at that different ways, and it involves, you know, where you place the blame, essentially. But McGinn, yeah, he was an outsider. He ran as an outsider. He wanted to be a kind of outsider mayor. And the ruling coalition, so to speak, that he fractured or broke to get there, committed from day one, from his first year, to painting him as an obstructionist, as someone who you couldn't get along with. He didn't do himself a lot of favors in countering that image. He kind of embraced it and then walked away from it. But there was a clear drumbeat and repetition of stories and concern from places like the Chamber of Commerce and council members that reinforced a negative image of McGinn that was very simple. He doesn't get along with people. He doesn't play nice. He doesn't want to get things done the Seattle way.
Well, let's forgive the first year just theoretically here for a second and say that year didn't happen. I did an interview with him at the two-year point, and he was very conciliatory there about a couple of things. But what I don't know and what I wonder is if some of that conciliatory kind of I got to work with everybody really did then happen and people wouldn't forgive him, or he didn't do that groundwork. That's a question. It seemed like maybe he was doing some of that on the NBA thing, because there he was with Dow Constantine. But I was at that press conference and McGinn was leaning physically toward Dow Constantine, the county executive, who was sort of leaning away from him. Just this sort of, I don't want to get too close.
And there was a lot that was done on the council. I mean, to your question, did he try to become more of a, I don't know, a team player, I guess, so to speak, and was, you know, not embraced in that? I think there is a lot of evidence of that the council didn't forgive him and said, no, we're not going to work with you. And when we don't work with you, which causes you to get nothing done, we're going to blame you for not being able to get anything done.
But there's a big distance between didn't forgive and five council members standing up on behalf of your opponent, Ed Murray, as they did.
I actually viewed that as a sign of not forgiving.
All right, let me take a break. We'll come back and we're going to touch on what's happening with Boeing and some of the other issues, including talk about whales as well and Coltrane's Bellevue Christmas. And don't forget, we also have a Week in Review Extra, which you can listen to on the record today at about 1:20, I think. Oh, I'm wrong again. 12:45. It's a good thing somebody knows when things are happening. And we're going to talk about that transition there. This is KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Opera, presenting Rigoletto. In Verdi's tragedy, a callous court jester finds himself caught in a web of corruption, lechery, and revenge. January 11th through the 25th at McCaw Hall. Details at seattleopera.org.
They would love a base hit into the gap.
It was the final game of the 1995 Division Championship Series. The Yankees were in the outfield, the Mariners were at bat, and Dave Niehaus was at the mic.
The throw to the plate will be late. The Mariners are going to play for the American League Championship. I don't believe it.
Remembering the late Dave Niehaus, the voice of the Seattle Mariners. That's on the next This Not Just In.
And you'll hear that later today on The Record on KUOW. Begins at noon. 51 degrees in Seattle with clouds and a few sunbreaks. Forecast says scattered showers today with a high of 52. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1041.
This is the Week in Review on KUOW. Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knut Berger. The Washington legislature is meeting in special session to vote on millions of dollars in tax exemptions for Boeing. Not every business gets that kind of attention, but Boeing is an economic driver of this state. So do you agree we should give tax breaks to Boeing? And will we get back more than we give? We're going to take that up on the record. So call our feedback line, 206-221-3663. Do you think the state's going too far in courting Boeing? Let us know either way, 221-3663. What do you guys think? Special session coming?
Special session
happened. Here we
happening
are.
Right here, right now. Right here,
arms
right
being twisted, there's Boeing machinists being...
There's a little mayhem going on here because it was all sort of presented as this neat and tidy package that everyone was going to go for. And now you're hearing the other pieces of it, including the fact that the machinists are not really... The leaders are not very excited about it, and I can't say what they said about it on your air.
No, you cannot. They find it to be a reprehensible bodily function.
Yes, there was that. And then there's a little pushback
in this case
from the legislature where they're saying that the last round of big, considerable tax breaks for Boeing were followed by a little wiggle room whereby they could do a second version of the 787 down there in South Carolina, and they seem to want sort of more assurances that not happen this time if all these pieces fit together.
We have heard back and forth from dueling analysts who's saying Boeing has the leverage or Boeing doesn't have the leverage, so that Everett's in a better position or it's not because South Carolina has so much land. Did Boeing learn lessons of the 787, or are they going to repeat them, or did they improve upon them with the 777X? But so that's the horse trading going on. But what do you think of that question that other people are asking here? Is it a good deal overall?
Well, is it a good deal? I thought one of the interesting things was Governor Inslee's office issued a letter that Boeing had written it was a one-paragraph letter being extremely explicit about what they expected. I think it is the most explicit ransom note that Boeing has ever issued. And it basically said, they clearly went to Boeing and said, what do you want to stay here, period? You tell us what you want, and then we'll get it done. And, that involves the union, the machinists approving concessions. It involves, these additional tax breaks. It involves passing a transportation package. And so this is a high-risk gamble for Inslee, I think, because, if he succeeds – I'm just talking about in political terms – if he succeeds in keeping Boeing here and getting all this stuff passed, it'll have to be done on a bipartisan basis. If he succeeds, it will be a real coup. I mean, in terms of gubernatorial perceived, gubernatorial, but it has so many ways it could fail.
But he doesn't have a choice in that he could say, "Well, okay, thanks for your letter. I'll talk to you later." He can't do that. He has to walk through the steps.
That's right. And so we're about to see what will happen. I find this completely unsurprising. We've seen it coming for ages. We caved, to Boeing back during that we had bipartisan Dino Rossi and Gary Locke. Gave them huge concessions. There, even though the state constitution prohibits us from crafting laws to benefit a specific business, that is just like the veil on that is just completely torn off now. I mean, nobody is discussing, well, this is for the benefit of the aerospace industry. This is the benefit for one company keeping it here and making concessions that make us competitive with South Carolina. This is part of the race to the bottom, which is you're going to pay more money, more tax subsidies for less. And, and people are going to weigh that because obviously those jobs are really, really important to the economy. But there's no from what I'm hearing, they're going to argue the details, but there's no principled opposition to the concept of being strong-armed like this.
In terms of the political fallout for Inslee, I actually see a win-win here. If Boeing gets what it wants and stays, then he can be the governor who helped keep Boeing here. If, say, the Republican-controlled Senate doesn't agree to the package that would keep Boeing here, then Inslee and Democrats can say, we tried, and it was Republicans who wouldn't agree on, say, a transportation package or something, who caused Boeing to leave, and they can kind of flip the normal script that has existed in this state and run on it.
Well, they were really going back and forth this week on the transportation package, whether that was essential to getting this thing going, or is that something on the horizon, or is that something you have to do lickety-split in the next week? And what I'm hearing is that the transportation package isn't quite soup yet, that they're too busy, you know, trying to figure out what goes into the transportation. Now, clearly it's roads and transit. What's the mix? Who will buy in? Depending on that mix, that isn't ready yet. So I'm not sure that will happen in the 1 week special session time frame.
Yeah, don't you think they're going to have to extend the special session? I mean, they don't
It makes it less special if you do that.
But we know that they almost always get extended.
So what is it that Boeing's getting a sales tax? What is it, almost $10 billion to get through 2040? $8.7 billion. The machinists are going to vote on this, but they are they out of it, basically, on this? I mean, whatever the machinists do, well, they're still going to push this package through.
Well, did you see that there were the comments from the leaders of the machinists,
yeah,
followed by Jay Inslee's going to talk to those very leaders today?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's complicated because all the pieces have to fall together. And the other thing that you're not seeing is what kind of concessions will have to be made in order to get the votes. I would be really surprised if this package passes without seeing
the transpo package or the whole thing?
The whole thing. Uh-huh. Without seeing some pushback from people on, say, B&O tax reform for the rest of us. In other words, you already hear the grumbling about that, you know, that we have a tax system that so much favors Boeing and they get concessions on the B&O and small business people are not paying taxes on their profits. They're paying taxes on their revenues. And it's really hard for a lot of small businesses. What do they get? And so I would be surprised if there's not some kind of horse trading where the effect and cost of subsidizing Boeing is going to mean that they've got to show some other people some benefit other than just Boeing jobs.
Interesting. By the way, in Bellingham, as you said, the slate of opponents to the coal trains won in their county council elections, and in Bellevue. What was the outcome there? You've tracked that a little bit.
Those people. It's interesting because Bellevue has now moved from opposing light rail trains, not coal trains, but light rail trains, to a council that's much more sympathetic, I think, to the changes that are going to be happening in Bellevue, and that the city itself can either drag its feet on or embrace. And of course, we knew that in the primary. The incumbent Don Davidson, longtime kind of guy in the Kemper Freeman camp, was defeated. We had two newcomers who got that, and the one that won, Lynn Robinson, is a longtime Bellevue activist and parks advocate. She was very well known in Bellevue. So one of the things that from people I've talked to is that Bellevue is searching for a new city manager. And I think they're down to a final group of candidates, but nobody's picked one. Who's going to pick that city manager? Is it going to be the new council or the old council? But that person, the mayor of Bellevue, is selected is on the city council. So the city manager is a very powerful position. And when you're talking about the transformation of like the Bell Red Corridor, you're talking about bringing light rail in, you're talking about the costs and permitting and whatnot associated with that, it really matters who's running the city government there. And I think the new council will be much more sympathetic to that.
Well, it's just
kind of
the shift of that
argument.
One key position, the Davidson position, that's making so much difference.
So is it still Kemper Freeman's Bellevue?
You know, he's getting a run for his money, and I think you've got some interesting kind of big player forces playing off one another, and you might say it's Kemper Freeman versus Wright Runstad. It's downtown Bellevue versus the Bell Red Corridor. You have visions that are very much toward urbanizing Bellevue, but the winners and losers are a different set of folks.
All right, I want to ask about a few things, and I'm going to do it in a magical way. I'm going to do a story next week on SAD, seasonal affective disorder, because we think about it. And I'm going to ask you guys some questions. But first, I'm going to ask Luke Burbank, who is host of LiveWire, and thinking about it. Luke, do you get SAD? Do you get seasonal affective disorder?
I didn't used to. You know, I grew up in Seattle, and I had the normal hardy Seattleites tolerance for the weather. And then when I moved away to Los Angeles, I lost it, and I have not been able to get my my moss back yet, with all due respect to Skip. And so this week, I had to go out on a job really early on Thursday morning, and I got up and I was leaving the house. It was like 5:30 in the morning, and it was raining, and I thought, and so it begins. And I'm just wondering from the group, I mean, how do you guys deal with the fact that we are now entering in an 8 to 9 month period of terrible weather and darkness and just, you know, a really unfun place to live in this country?
Well, Skip just fluffs up his moss back.
You know, it's interesting because I have a family member who has the SAD thing, and she, you know, born and raised here. You know, you have it or you don't, and it's really tough on folks.
Yeah.
For me, that the worst day is the day you turn the clocks back, because it's 5 o'clock and suddenly the ceiling comes down that you didn't expect it, and it's just so dark. But over time, I guess many of us get used to it, but it is something to deal with.
I'm with Joni. When the time changes and it kind of darkness comes down at 4 o'clock, it's brutal and you feel it. And I'm also with Luke in the sense that I grew up here and felt like I had a certain sort of immunity, or I was used to it, and it's evaporated as I've gotten older. It's not getting stronger. So I try to get out of Seattle a little bit during the winter if I can.
It's evaporated for me too. I can't handle it. What do you do, Luke? Do you just go to more dark places and drink? What do you do?
I mean, sure. I mean, that's one of the ways that I try to not feel my feelings. I think you and I have both tried to not feel our feelings together, Cher. I definitely think if you can, and of course this is a luxury, but if you can get out of Seattle for a couple of little jaunts to places that are sunnier, that certainly helps. But I don't know. I mean, I just I'm also really affected by the lack of light. I don't know if I actually have a diagnosable seasonal. Is it affected or affect disorder?
I think it's affected, but I don't know.
I don't know if I have. I don't think I have. I don't think I necessarily have the syndrome. I don't have one of those light boxes set up. But I know that when it gets dark at 4 p.m, I feel like a farmer. I feel like I should just start, you know, living by the sun, and then when it's dark, it's just time to get under the blankets and go to bed or something. You know what I mean? I have no motivation to do anything past like 3:30 in the afternoon.
Well, yeah, we're all really just bears.
But we had the most spectacular summer here, and I wonder if that just spoiled us, or if that made this whole thing, you know, worse, because it's not that time.
I keep thinking about this line I read in a Harvey Manning book, that it was, I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like November weather fertilizes April's suicides.
By April everything's pretty cool. No, April's great. Best trees of the year.
In terms of getting away and the luxury of being able to fly off to somewhere, there are places closer and within Washington State.
Sun Lakes?
Sure. You can go over the mountains or up to the San Juans, where they get a lot less rain.
Is that a real thing, though? Because I feel like I've been to a lot of places that are in these supposed banana belts.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, I'm ready to hit like Club Med.
Yeah.
And then I realize, oh, this is just Squim. And it's pretty rainy still, actually.
There aren't that many bananas in Squim, is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, there are not enough.
Banana-free Squim.
Well, one of the ways you can think about this, or ways to look forward to it, for me anyways, is the holiday season. But here's my transition. By the way, I'm really good at this. And you stay here, Luke, for this, because Skip wrote about a war on gay Christmas.
Well, I didn't write about it. I just noted the fact that the Hallmark Company was in trouble for these ornaments that had Christmas lyrics, and one of the lyrics on this thing was from Deck the Halls, and so they changed. Don We Now Our Fun Apparel. And because they didn't want anybody to misconstrue what the word gay meant nowadays. And this has created this huge huzzabazoo.
I think the question is, who was having problem with this? I mean, where's the evidence of the problem?
Luke was having problems with it. Right?
I did. I have to say, as a 9-year-old, I snickered inside every time I sang it, not knowing as much about the world as I do now. But here's the question: is this necessarily motivated from a negative place, or is this, or is it because they're just trying to clarify what they're saying? Is it motivated from a place of, like, heaven forbid someone say we're referring to gay people? Or is it just because they want to be more clear with the language?
The geographic place was St. Louis, Missouri, I think. Mm-hmm. And so there was some thought that it was not coming just from a place of clarification. But
that's a tough call, right? Because if it happened in Vermont, you would know it wasn't meant to be hurtful. And if it happened in Texas, you would know it was meant to be hurtful. St. Louis is right on the line. It could kind of go either way.
Either way.
I just want to know why I haven't heard the word huzzabazoo before.
I know. Breaking news. Huzzabazoo is a word.
What's on your show tonight on the Live Wire? That's on the KUOW at the 8 o'clock.
That's right, 8 p.m. tonight. Well, we have this actually a Seattle, you could say, cartoonist, Peter Bagg, who has written a lot of interesting stuff over the years. He actually has a new book out about Margaret Sanger, of all people. And that motivated us to also talk to my actual parents, who are sort of the anti-Margaret Sangers, in that they are the parents of 7 kids. So I interviewed my parents about why it is that they had so many children, if it was just because they were not interested in birth control. And my mom explained to me that having 7 kids represented them actually actively trying to use birth control. She said if they had not
just not
used
succeeding,
birth control, it would have been 12 kids.
Oh my
gosh.
This
is a thing she really said to me. It blew my mind this week.
By the way, I like that on a variety show you'll have a cartoonist. Will he draw on stage, or will he just hold up pictures of his book?
He, you know what? There was some suggestion in the production meeting about having him draw while talking, and I said, I'm pretty sure that's a bad idea for radio. This is a fairly non-visual medium. So he describes Margaret Sanger really, really interestingly. And here's the thing about tackling a historical figure in a comic book, basically, is he was able to transmit all this interesting stuff about Margaret Sanger's life that I would have never read if it was in sort of a dry, typical book about Margaret Sanger. In fact, Paul Constant wrote a review in The Stranger, Eli, which you probably saw, where he said he thought it was Peter Bagg's best work ever. And I thought this is how more pieces about historical events and people should be written, because I breezed through it and I feel like I know something about Margaret Sanger now, and I wouldn't have known it otherwise.
You just described the marketing strategy for Classics Comics.
I was just going to say that.
I know.
You missed out the whole thing. All right. Luke, thank you.
Sure. Thanks, guys.
We'll see you again. You know, we didn't get to 3 kinds of whales I wanted to talk about, or the transition, which we're going to take up on the Week in Review Extra. You can hear that on the record at 12:45. Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
This is KUOW, Seattle.